Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. My name is Scott Lind, and I'm your host. Got some great stuff in store for you. If you are a student, as I am, of all things uplands, the birds, the habitat, and particularly the dogs, should be a very interesting and enlightening podcast. Steve Grossman, is my principal guest today. He'll be talking all things prairie birds, rough grouse, dogs, dog training, travel tips. It's all in store for you on the Upland Nation podcast. Outfitted by Cabela's. Plus, I'll offer up a spot I love for Montana sharp tails that any schmo can go to for the cost of some fuel and boot leather. And working all through this whole tailgate exam thing for your dog. So some of the overlooked aspects of that are also in store for you right here on the Upland Nation podcast. Stick around. I hope you'll learn something. And believe it or not, you're all going to be contributing in one way or another to the discussion, but that's in a moment. Just about everywhere, the hunting season is underway, whether it started with prairie grouse or doves or forest grouse. In some states, you were hunting as early as September. Hope it's going well, and hope it continues to go well. We're still dealing with a little bit of the residual smoke from some of those million acres up in smoke here in Oregon, but it's not going to stop me. It's probably not going to stop you either. All right. So, you know, I love talking with you on social media, and I hope you'll watch the videos as they are continuing to stream through that distribution channel. But we know it's all, you know, it's all in one, context, the birds, the dogs, and the habitat. So a while back on Facebook, I posted a picture of one of my rigs from years past in a stunning chucker hunting location. And I said, can you top this? And you did. Tom Kerber sure did. Believe it or not, in central Ohio, what I like about your picture, Tom, is that it is pretty much basically a bird hunting mecca. It looks like cut crops, and there's a dog in the distance, and I can't quite tell, but it looks like he's on point. So, no, I cannot beat that. But Ricky Buchanan probably did. He's showing me a broom sage field in North Florida on a bobwhite hunt that, man, it brings back some great memories of a show we did down there many years ago. I think the place is called Quail Creek. Wonderful Orvis endorsed lodge down there. Took a 16-year-old gal and her dad on her birthday. That was the prize, and we had a wonderful time. Dan Lenson can't be overtopped, though. He's shown me the Palouse region of eastern Washington. Looks a lot like some of the country I hunt. And finally, my good friend Mark Avolio, chucker hunter extraordinaire and hunting partner for me as well, showing me their chucker camp on a lake that, well, he told everybody about it, so I can too, Lake Owyhee. It's right there on the Owyhee River in southeast Oregon. It looks like a good time, Mark, and hopefully we'll be doing that again real soon. Thank you all for being a part of the Upland Nation on all the Facebook pages, particularly the Upland Nation page and the Wing Shooting USA page. So keep checking in once in a while. I hope you'll watch the videos. Hey, do me a favor. Share those videos as well. There's usually something for everybody in there, and there's usually something for folks who are a little more experienced and a little bit less experienced. So appreciate your getting the word out on those so that it will help everybody become a better hunter, better dog owner, and a better shooter. Thanks a bunch. Hey, the Upland Nation podcast is brought to you in part by Sage and Breaker Gun Care Products, always crafted at the highest caliber, and so are their videos. Just reviewed their video on shotgun bore cleaning with their bore snake device. Love it. Love it. I remember when they first came out many years ago. They're still probably as useful to me as canned beer, And that means real useful. Watch the video, see what I mean. Free shipping on everything there. Sign up for the mailing list as well. And Dogtra.com. All sorts of great things going on there, including that new rating. They are the most waterproof, and they can prove it. Collars and transmitters on the market. More on that later on in the podcast. Yeah, enough about me and enough about you. Now it's time to talk about our guest, Steve Grossman. Yeah, I know. What else you gonna be with a name like that? Steve, welcome to the program. Hope you're doing well.
I'm good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to touch on your background just a little bit, and then I'm going to ask you for the whole story. But you're an Orvis-endorsed wing shooting outfitter. You have a grouse hunting lodge up in Minnesota. You now have a prairie lodge in South Dakota. And, you know, after that, I think I should probably leave it up to you. Why don't you give us the kind of the Reader's Digest version of what Steve Grossman Grossman is all about?
Well, geez, you know, I've got a degree in game and fish from the University of Minnesota, Crookston. And right out of college, I managed a hunt club in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And about 4.5 years later, we came back to Minnesota and started a little Moran hunt club. And during that time, I started doing, I had some good success with our dog training. And I became one of the lead guides or lead trainers for Burnt Creek Setters in Bismarck. And so about 3 years into that, after in 1987, I started a rough grouse and woodcock lodge, and we've been guiding grouse and woodcock hunts ever since. We've since closed the shooting preserve, so I'm not doing anything with the pinreared birds anymore. And then about 10 years ago, I was invited to a new lodge out in West Central South Dakota. And that went over great, and I eventually was able to lease a lodge by myself where we focus predominantly on sharptail, prairie chicken, and Hungarian. So it's been a great ride for 40-some years.
Yeah, I bet it has. It's an interesting process, so we're going to talk about that whole aspect of it in a moment. But before we get too deep into this, if somebody wants to talk with you and book a hunt or something along those lines, what is the best website address for them?
Probably the best one. You could either go to thegrosslodge.com or wildprairielodge.com, and that'll get you either to either place. They kind of direct. The Wild Prairie Lodge is suited for our prairie bird in South Dakota. And, of course, the grouselodge.com is the rough grouse and woodcock lodge here in Minnesota. So, or if you Google, you know, Little Moran Grouse Lodge, it'll bring you right up. So you'd be good to go that way.
There you go. Steve Grossman Grossman is my guest here on the Upland Nation podcast. Steve, you've been around. Not only are you have you got the practical experience, but you also have the academic background to know this stuff inside and out. But before we get deeper into all of that, let's get down to brass tacks. Here we go. If you had to, would it be forest grouse or prairie birds?
My favorite would still probably be rough grouse.
And side by side or an over and under?
Side by side.
Flusher, pointer, or setter?
All of the above.
There you go. You're one of us, and we knew that going in, but way to go. Looking forward to learning more about what you do and why you do it, which is kind of where I like to start. With those parameters, especially the last one, what is it that still trips your trigger about bird hunting?
It has been from the very get-go and will continue to be. It's all about the dogs. And once, you know, it's to watch dogs on the prairie, they lace through the cover, sweep the cover. You can watch it all happen. And then in the grouse woods, you become so in tune. I always run a bell. And you become so in tune that pretty quick the bell starts. It's just like speaking to you. You can tell what the dog is doing just by the tone of the bell and what's happening that way. So, you know, it's it's all about the dogs and the dog work.
You said you love them all, but your background betrays you slightly. Are you still running mainly setters, or what's your principal dog breed out there?
I am. I run all setters. I've got a Labrador that I use when I'm guiding pheasants. I've got some great guides that are running English pointers. For myself, it was one of those things that after all these years, I'd be kind of like a Benedict Arnold if I switched to something else. You know, when I started in 84, I had short hairs, and for a period of time, I had about 10 that I used for guide dogs on the game farm. But once I started doing more with the rough grouse and woodcock, the setter was just a better choice.
In better in what way? Because I'm just cringing thinking about all the stuff that we run into when we're out in your country that sticks to dogs. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, it's a common mistake or a common question that I'm asked by a lot of people. They'll ask me, well, you know, I'm a continental breed or another setter or pointer, and they'll slow down or almost come to a point. You'll see them get birdie, and then they take one more step and the bird goes, or they've already established point and they want to get just a little bit closer and they take another step and the bird goes. So the thing for me with setters, two things actually, you know, with all the old art and the old history with grouse and woodcock hunting in New England, setter was the dog of choice. And once I started with Burnt Creek setters, the setter, because I had access to a lot of really nice setters, they just became my dog of choice because I had rough grouse right here on the farm. So that was it was a great, and it was an easy choice that way. When it comes to the reason why, is I think that they've got just a little bit more of a sensitive nose, and they have a tendency to, once they stop to point, I can keep them there. They're not good strong retrievers. And I think in some instances that is why that they're better in that regard, because they don't have they don't crowd their birds. They point off their birds a long way.
Yeah, I like that. Somebody would suggest that is a great nose. Others might agree with what you've just stated, which is, it sounds like they might just be a little bit more cooperative with us, understand that's what we want. I'm thinking of my three-year-old wire hair right now, who continues to vex me once a week with crashing in on a bird. He's got so much something. I don't know what it is, disobedience or prey drive. I like to pretend that's what it is.
I'm sure it's prey drive.
And if he was a female, maybe it wouldn't be that way. Yeah, you know, you got a preference? Do you run girls and boys or
I, what do I you, do. I don't. It doesn't matter to me as long as they go out and do their job.
Yeah.
And for our dogs, you know, our guide dogs, they have to, you know, I have to count on them every day. So it's, you know, when we're guiding 70, 80 days out of the year with the same 8 or 10 dogs, they're just like it's a great team. And when or if those dogs fail me or fail the hunters, I mean, it's like dropping a touchdown pass. And so it's awful important. And I've just had incredible fortune and great success with the dog maintaining and something I can count on every day I take them out.
You know, that just begs the next question, which is, how do you keep these dogs happy and healthy through a guide season? I mean, nobody I know, except pro guides, is running their dogs that frequently for that long a season. What do you do in terms of conditioning and diet and care at the end of the day that, you know, just in a nutshell, ensures that you're going to have great dogs the next day?
Well, the most, it's a great question. And I had that issue many, many years ago, and where my dogs hit the wall and I had to scab a few dogs together to get through the last week or so of the season. And it came back to bite me. But so to answer that question, it's topping off their fuel tank at the end of the day. So if I'm running six dogs and we hunt four grouse covers a day, I run two dogs in a cover. So what I'll do is I'll run my A-team, the first cover in the morning. They're down for a couple hours. Each group of dogs or each brace of dogs are really down for maybe 2 to 2.5 hours, and then they're put up for the day. So they're not grinding it out all day long. They've got some time to rest during the day. But even though I that kind of a hunt, the important thing is to top off the tank and give them a dog food which replenishes what they lose during the day, something that's got a really great great calorie count, something that's very user friendly for the dog, that the dog can end up that they can use out of the food. That's important. And when I'm on the road or traveling, then when I was with Purina for so many years, and I still am very focused on some of their products, is a product called 40 Flora.
Yeah,
which is a great supplement you can add to the food for gut health and different things when you're on the road and different things that way. But the number one thing is, early fall conditioning. We rode the dog, get them in shape. And the other thing is we give them plenty of water. We carry a lot of water in the field, and the combination of all those things are a big part of it.
You talk about topping off the tank, and this is an ongoing problem with my young dog. And you've probably come up with some things that help. Fortiflora, you mentioned. I'm asking everybody I know who has the same, kind of high volume, big running dog experience. Do you ever add anything at the end of the day to that dog food to get him to eat that food?
Late in the year, and that too is a great question. Late in the year, then I will add canned dog food. Just if they're tired and they're really getting beat up, then late in the year I will add canned dog food and water, warm water to make it just a little bit more easier and more palatable that way. But I don't. There's one other that, and it's interesting. Very few people that have come through in all these years are aware of it. And I can't tell you who makes it, but it's a product called NutriCal, N-U-T-R-I.
I know it well.
NutriCal is a great fixer-upper. It's a great boost for the dogs. It's very high in caloric content, and I just put a dab on my fingers and rub it on their gums, and it sure helps in a lot of ways.
I've searched high and low for something that would put more calories into my dogs. And this was 3 or 4 dogs ago. Found another version from Drs. Foster and Smith, and then found the Crunch Pemmican Energy Bar that now I'm a distributor of, but I won't bore anybody with that. But there are all sorts of ways to get more calories into a dog. And the key, of course, is, as you know, density, I guess I'll call it, caloric density is the key. Because do you feed your dog in the morning before a hunt?
No, I feed him. I never feed a dog and then take him out. Everything is at the end of the day after they've had a chance to, calm down for 45 minutes to an hour.
Yeah.
And it's just a once a day feeding, but in each dog, you find those that are easy keepers, and then you find some that need a little bit more TLC, and they're all different.
My guy's the opposite. He's a hard keeper, and he cannot, the challenge becomes his stomach is just not big enough to hold enough calories at the end of the day, unless you do what you've described, supplement it in some way so that he can burn through that fuel over the course of a 5-day hunt.
Well, you do. And the key to it is, think of yourself, with after a big meal or going out to walk in or any exercise with a full stomach. And at some point, that's kind of the same for a dog, I would think. I got to meet when I was, working for Purina, I got to meet a lot of great field trialers and pick up on a few of their things. And that was always the key, is even at a big event, there would sometimes they would fast the dog for 24 hours prior to that event.
Yeah.
And it just made that little bit more of a difference.
Well, you know this because you worked with them, but Purina's done all the research on that. And a dog with an empty gut from the belly on back is going to perform better that day. And so that idea of fasting a dog seems to make a lot of sense. We'll get back into the dog thing, but I want let's just dwell for a couple minutes on some of the protocols. You know, for some people, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. For some lucky television hosts, it's a whole bunch of times every season, but we get to work with great professional guides and outfitters, dog handlers, whatever you want to call them. Let's talk a little bit about this in, you know, from a guy who experiences all of this and then also manages a bunch of other guys like that. How can we help you and your guys excel when we're the client?
Probably the number one thing is don't talk to my dogs. You know, that's a big thing. It's don't handle my dogs. You know, I'm the handler. That's what I'm there for. If they come by or if you want to pet them and tell them they're a good boy, that's fine. But when people start trying to handle or hack on my dogs, that's the baddest of all of them. So that would be one. The other thing is that happens so much of the time, especially out in the prairie, on the prairie and in the grouse woods, our people become very tentative of going into the point. Like they're scared. They want to get a flush the bird if they charge in there. It's more people than not, what they will do is they get to the dog and stop.
Yeah.
And it's forever going to happen out in front. Sometimes just like this last couple weeks, the sharp tail have been spooky as can be. So they're flushed in 45 to 50 yards in front of the dog, even with young birds. And if you were still back at the dog and you weren't being aggressive getting through to get in front of the dog to flush the bird, you're taking yourself right out of shot. You're taking yourself out of play.
Amen. I'll never forget. In fact, my throat hurts just thinking about it. We had a guy in a party in South Dakota that he was mincing his way in from about 80 yards out, and my dog was just barely finished at that point. And he was, you know, you watch that dog and he starts to quiver. And then it's like an earthquake, and you know he's about ready to crash. And that guy is still, like you said, 50 yards away, sneaking up on the bird.
Absolutely.
I was yelling the whole time. It didn't help, and it probably cost me a friend. But anyway.
But that does happen. And so it's, you know, and then the other issue at times is we've got hunters that will want to bring their own dogs. And we're happy that they do bring them because they're an important part of your hunt and you're your hunting partner. And so there are going to be those times where we may respectfully just say, you know what, hunt your dog and I'm going to leave mine in the truck. And so the whole thing, when it comes from a guiding standpoint, it is the client's day. It is the guest's day. It's not the guide's day. And so everyone that comes in, especially all our guides, the first thing look, you guys, this is not your day. These are the hunter's day. That's what they're here for. They run their own dogs. Then that's what we do. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. You know, you are Orvis endorsed. Other guys at your level, of your caliber, all say something along those same lines. The fundamental idea being, we are in the customer service business. We're not in the bird killing business. Am I right on that?
That you are 100% spot on. This whole business is service and hospitality, taking care of your clients. And the bird hunting is just what we're doing for the day. And that's really what it comes down to. But number one, it's taking care of your clients.
Answer the question once and for all. I'm going to just guess. I haven't looked at your rates, but I'm going to guess that if a guy wants to come to your prairie lodge and hunt for a rough, let's call it a 3-day hunt, and it works out to $7,000 a day. Am I close on that?
Say that again. Repeat.
What's the average per day cost for your services, either in the woods or on the prairie?
You're going to be upwards of $1,000 a day. Yeah. Yeah. Depending on the situation and the best part, I guess, if there's any way that a person can justify and say why, what makes that worth that, would be one, quality dogs if dogs are needed. Mm-hmm. Two would be knowledge of the game, where they live, So each, from the very get-go, from the minute you get to the lodge and we start hunting, you're into birds until the end of the day. All 3 days, you're into birds. And so you're not wasting a lot of time looking for cover, driving around, if you're self-hunting. And many people do, and I mean, it's great. I'm encouraging the self-hunter, no question. But what it does is if you're short on time, it gives you 3 days of great opportunities and good hunting and plenty of dog power. And like with both our lodges, we're all inclusive. So we provide the meals, lodging, and the whole works.
And well worth the cost. And I want to say the investment, not the cost. I mean, in the TV business, time is money. It costs me. I pay everybody by the day. If we're not finding birds, then we got to stay another day. And that costs me a lot more money. So I get it. And I am lobbying strongly for everybody else to think about the value of their time when they're not shooting at birds, when they're driving instead, whatever it is. The reason I ask it, though, is not because of that. And by the way, you will get your money's worth from a guy like Steve Grossman, I can assure you. The reason I ask is, at the end of the day or at the end of the trip, we're kind of confused and kind of shy about the tip. What's a good tip amount or a range for guys of your caliber and the guys who work for you?
Well, you know, it's a wonderful question, and I'm asked that by every hunter that comes into the lodge, and I just say, you know, it as a rule, these guys have got a lot of time and energy into their dogs and their gear and electric collars, GPS collars. They've got, you know, but they take a lot of pride and a lot of, you know, vet bills and food bills, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I guess what I would do is if it's two guns, easily start at 50 to 75 a day per gun. And then you can work up from there, or you can just leave it right at that. And that's, you know, somewhere in that ballpark. And there are guys that'll say, all right, that's all I needed to know. And then it'll be a $200 or $300 tip per guide. Mm-hmm. And so much of it, again, is, you know, it's like if you go into a restaurant and even though people are expected a tip, and if the service is poor or people are not friendly and they wonder why there wasn't much of a tip, it would be for that reason. And the same comes into play here.
Yeah.
So, you know, our guides, you know, we encourage them to, you know, in the morning, you know, their truck is clean and, you know, just so people aren't just sitting into a, so it's just a good experience all around, and that's really the whole thing. And when that experience happens, the tips are better. And so that's an important tip for if someone's listening who's another guide or wants to guide, those are just some things to keep in mind.
Thanks. That helps a lot. And I'm sure there are people out there that will be applying your guidelines this year. So appreciate that. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, the host. That's Steve Grossman, and it's time to get down to it. Speaking of grouse, you just wrapped up your prairie grouse season out in South Dakota. Tell us where you are when you're out there, and then let's talk about the season.
I am West River, west of the Missouri River, so I would be west and a little bit south of Mulbridge, out in a little village called Whitehorse, South Dakota. And so we've got an incredible amount of native prairie, and that's where we do all our bird hunting, is on native prairie. We're coming off, you know, last year was a good year, and the ranchers out there this year said they'd never seen more birds. And we had some incredibly great days, a lot of birds. Some of the things that surprised, even though we had really good bird numbers, was the lack of food on the prairie this year. And so when we could find buffalo berry, that was money. And in years past, when we would find rose hips, that was money. But this year, the rose hips, and talking to some of the ranchers, that a bad couple nights of a frost came through early in the year when those rose hip bushes were blooming. And that's what was the cause of lack of rose hips. But it was a good fall.
You know, we talked about this a week or two ago as well. And it seems like there, almost always there's something fruiting or blooming or that the birds will find. But what else are they eating? What else are you finding in your birds' crops when you're out there?
Predominantly it's grasshoppers this time of year yet, and then rose hips. But now this year buffalo berry and grasshoppers. We're finding some weed seeds and a little bit of other bugs and crickets and things of that nature. But right now that's number one. Grasshoppers, crickets, etc. are so. They pack on the meat and fat, you know, going into the winter. That puts them in great shape. That's a positive. And so because you've got grasshoppers everywhere, and in most cases we've got buffalo berry everywhere, you know, it's not like going into a prolonged wheat stubble field or a sunflower stubble or corn stubble and knowing that you're going to have birds feeding on those edges. So those are destinations for birds to be. But out where we're at on the prairie, it's not so. There's not very many destinations for the birds to be, other than, the birds like to be on the east side of the hills. Where we're at, out in the western part of South Dakota, is we're on the breaks of the Missouri River and the Moreau River, and so we've got it's nothing like eastern South Dakota. We've got buttes and draws and it's very picturesque and landscape is spectacular, but it changes as well because of that, and you have to change your way of hunting.
You know, I love that country, and I spend a lot of time out there, but I also go east of the river and spend a lot of time on that really, table flat stuff. To a great degree, we call them prairie grouse because they're on the prairies. It's grass. Do you ever find any greens in these birds' crops?
We'll find some greens in them, absolutely. I'm ignorant on this at this point because it's been so long ago that I had my work with the game and fish. I've got one genus and species that I always remember that someone will ask me, well, what's this? And I said, well, it looks like a Saxifragus sarmentosa.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what I thought, too, yeah.
Yeah, and they were looking at me like, okay, so what's a Saxifragus sarmentosa? I said, it's a strawberry begonia. And that's the only Latin that I could remember from my college days. So then we'll go to the next, and they say, well, what's this one? I said, well, that's a Saxifragus sarmentosa. And they look at me and said, you said the last one was just that.
That's like all the little birds in our backyard are LBBs, little brown birds.
Yes, yeah. Little brown birds. So it's, but you, we do, but you know what? If I was out there now or going out tomorrow to hunt again, I would 100% focus on sides of the hills where you've got buffalo berry if you could still find some rose hips. It's like anything else. Why, if they can eat right in the living room, then they can sit right in the living room and eat, and they don't have to travel far.
Oh, and again, you talk about caloric density or nutritional value in dog food.
Absolutely.
It's the same with bird food, and those things have just got to be much better than some grass blades or sage leaves or something like that.
Without question.
You mentioned one of my pet peeves, which is people trying to sneak up on a pointed bird, and we won't belabor that point. But other than that, out on the prairies, whether it's chickens, sharpies, or huns, what are some of the other things you guys just cringe at when we clients do it?
Well, another one is coming in too tight to the dog.
Yeah.
When they come into a point, you're far better off, even if you get to watch the first couple flushes and if the birds are spooky or if it's a real windy day, typically they're going to be more spooky, but you'd be far better off to stay wide from the dog and then kind of pinch in kind of a pie shape to the front of the dog, but stay wide as you come in and kind of work at that kind of an angle. That's another one. The other thing is, I guess at this point, that I always like to see guys, if it's a poorly hit bird, to get into it again. I could double tap it, shoot it twice, and to kill the bird. One other thing that can become a bit of an issue is if you have a down bird, and I know that hunters are trying to they're trying to help as well. But if we've got a wounded or crippled bird, the more we get involved in it and start walking around where the dogs are hunting dead, trying to locate that bird, we're kind of muddying the water and confusing the stuff. And whether they can get to that, I'm sure they can. But if we don't need to be there for the first go around with it, I prefer to let the dogs work that cover. And then if the dogs are still having issues, then I'll have the guys go in and start kicking grass and cover. But, you know, those are that, you know, walking, you know, be sure you're past the dog. Those are the biggest items. And of course, then not handling or hacking on your dog.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah, love it. And great advice, all of that. In fact, I just tossed off a magazine article, and all of those were in the sidebar. So
well,
watch
great.
For that in Sporting Classics magazine in a year or so. We're just getting warmed up here at the Upland Nation podcast. Steve Grossman, I'm gonna booger that up at some point, Steve. But
no, you're doing good. Just let her buck.
He's the Orvis Endorsed Orvis Endorsed Wing Shooting Outfitter. I know they make a distinction about all that stuff, but the guy knows of what he speaks. We've touched on a couple things already. We've still got rough grouse. We've got a couple things on the dog side, including a good friend of mine and his particular problem that I'm gonna have you've solved for me, Steve. But right now I'm going to give you just a moment to take a break while I come up with a few commercial messages. Just talked to Dr. Tim Hunt yesterday. DRTIMS.com is where you learn all about his many formulations of performance dog food. You want a grain-free? He's got it. You want one with heirloom grains? He's got it. And then the ones I rotate through, Momentum and Glacier, high protein, high fat this time of year is critical. Dogs get their energy in large part from fat, but they also need protein to rebuild their muscles and bones and ligaments and tendons. You want high quality protein, and for dogs that means animal sources. Dr. Tim's performance dog food has an overall average of 87% animal protein. None of this stuff from those other sources, whatever they are. Make a study of this stuff. Look at all of the nutritional information on the bag of yours and Dr. Tim's as well. Need an incentive, 30% off your first order. You know, they got codes all over the place there. You can use Upland Nation as the checkout code, but you don't have to. So check it all out. Learn more about dog nutrition at DRTIMS.com. Electronic earplugs. Yeah, they're a big deal for me because, you know, I was a little bit afraid. My wife was telling me I wasn't hearing what she was saying. Okay, that wasn't my ears. But I still had my ears checked out, and they are fine, but I want to keep them that way. That's why I went to ESPAmerica.com, got to know Jack Homa. Electronic Shooters Protection is the name of the company. Four different choices on electronic earplugs, something for everybody's budget. And because they're custom fit, they offer complete protection, and you can still hear your dog's collar tags, the flushing birds. You're on the range, you can hear the target thrower. And in my case, you can hear your friends laughing at your bad shooting. 30-day money-back guarantee. Get fitted locally. Learn all about where your local dealer is at ESPAmerica.com. All right. So, Steve Grossman, are you with me?
I'm with you.
Good, because you're going to help me on this one.
Bring it on.
All right, man. Yeah, we've talked around it a little bit, and I just finished a video on part one of a dog's tailgate exam is what I'm calling it. Can be called all sorts of things, and you might call it something else, but this is our Handle It segment where I talk about all things dogs that will help them stay healthy, happy, and perform at their peak. So at the end of the day, There are a few things that I do, and I'm not going to bore you with the whole detail yet, but when I'm checking out my dog on the tailgate, I run my hand down his spine and I press gently just to see if there's any sensitive spots. I flex all of their leg joints and then I pinch their withers, you know, right between their shoulder blades. Yep. And see if that snaps back, because if it doesn't, then Steve, you know better than me what that means. Can you tell everybody?
I've never had that happen with a setter, so I can't answer that question.
Well, because you carry a lot of water, and good on you, because that's a big mark of dehydration. So anyway, those are the things that I cover on the part one of my tailgate exam. Is there anything in particular that you guys do that maybe we haven't thought about?
Well, you know, we're in cactus country out in South Dakota, and mm-hmm. even a little bit when we're in Arizona at times, you know, so I check the pads. We got sand burrs, whether you're out in the prairies of out in western Oklahoma, North Texas. I mean, and we have sand burrs around the lodge out in South Dakota. So if the dogs are out running and they have just a few minutes, and I check for the sand burrs, I check for soreness in the feet and the pads. What I do instead of what I will grab their coat and pull it up and see how fast the coat reacts.
Yeah.
Or retracts to the body. And when that, so in that regard, that's more kind of my method of checking for dehydration. And the gums, check the dog's gums. If the gums are dry and they're not moist and gummy. But you know, the whole key is you, it's easier to carry water and have water with you. And then think of it this way, especially in these, with the pheasant season coming up here early out in South Dakota. And this last week we had 80 degree weather again. And the key to it is, if you think you're walking in, you know, only a half mile, you got to walk out a half mile. So now you're at a mile. And if it's 80 degrees and we're 80 degrees at shoulder height, it's got to be warmer down in the grass for where your dog is at, and it's a whole different process. And so take shorter runs with your dogs, you know, in that early in that warm season. You know, we've got a lot of my hunters anymore, you know, they're getting long in the tooth, and so they can't make a 2-hour run. So we'll make a small hunt. Maybe it's 45 out and 45 back, or maybe a half hour out and a half hour back. And then we're able to put a new dog in the ground, so we keep the dogs fresh at that point. So, but other than, you know, just weed seeds, you know, in their eyes, check their eyes. Of course, if a dog, in all these years, in 34, 35 years guiding in Minnesota, I've had one dog of my own come down there or hit a porcupine, but my gosh, out in South Dakota, they can't get up a tree where they can in Minnesota, so we get a lot more porcupine issues. And then when I'm in South Dakota for that, I carry a variety of different forceps, you know, for small, for the small quills versus sure. bigger quills, et cetera, so they don't slide through. But, you know, other than that, those, so, you know, another thing I do too, because, you know, we're out in rattlesnake country, is I keep Benadryl,
yeah,
both liquid and pill form in the truck in my first aid kit. And, knock on wood, in all these years, it's I buy a new bottle of it each year, just so I wanted to make sure it's fresh and good, but we've never had to crack it, so that's a good thing.
And I actually had a veterinarian tell me that that's the key with the liquid is it does go bad, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, great tips and great advice. And yes, count your blessings on the porcupine side and especially on the snake side. So good for you. All right, switch gears. We're home from the prairie and we're now up in the grouse woods. You're right at the beginning of your season up there. What do you think it's looking like, and on what are you basing those opinions?
We had a good year last year, better than we've had in years past. And so meaning good, what I mean by that is, we had an average flush rate of about 12 grouse a day, and our woodcock were close to 20 a day. So, you know, you're looking at a total of maybe 32 birds a day as an average flush rate. Now we don't count a reflush as a bird, so it doesn't give me any indication what the numbers are like by counting a reflush. So based on that, and in the spring drumming counts, and we were out on the farm here turkey hunting and out in the boat, that the drumming was very good, and so we're very optimistic about the rough grouse in Minnesota this year. An interesting thing, and I, you know, I'm sure not the person to go to on it, but the state of Pennsylvania has been very aggressive in what they've done, and there's a gal out there that kind of leading the charge, and I've worked with a retired game warden out that way who is helping her. And what's interesting is when they thought the West Nile virus was a cause of the issue was rough grouse, and it did have an issue when they first 6 years ago when they gathered numerous eggs of rough grouse to test and to see if they had any West Nile virus in them, they did not. And when they incubated those eggs and they inoculated those chicks then with West Nile, they wanted to see how the West Nile, what kind of an effect it had on the chicks. That was a very interesting study. What's happened in that 5 or 6 year period, those birds that have survived that are laying eggs now are passing the West Nile virus along in the eggs. So a large number of the or large percentage of the eggs that are now being tested are positive with West Nile. So then those chicks are already inoculated coming out of the shell. So, you know, leave it to Mother Nature to, you know, to find a way to make it work. And it's just kind of a speed bump here and there, but we're very optimistic for a good year.
That, you know, we talk about herd immunity with all the things that we humans are facing right now, but flock immunity also has its relevance. And I'm glad, absolutely, so glad to hear that. We're out in the West, the theory is the same thing happened to California pheasants, for example. And that gives me a little bit more hope down the road if we can get the habitat thing squared away over there as well. When you're taking somebody out, or you're just hunting for fun in the grouse woods, what's a broad strategy for you? You know, we've talked about out and back, and you know, some people like a big circle on the prairie. What are you going to do when you plan a grouse hunt?
It's nothing but edges. Yeah. I'm an edge guy. And even I'm an edge guy when I'm on the prairie. An edge might be on the prairie. It may be a draw, or it may be just where the rise comes up, where the butte comes up. So instead of walking down in the bottoms, I'm working that top edge. But when I'm in the grouse woods, let's say I'm in a 10-year clear cut, and there's a right on the edge of a 20-year clear cut, I want to hunt that edge. It's a break in the cover, and it changes its diversity. And it's easier for a bird to get in from one type of cover to the next just by simply running. So I like to work edges. And if it's a swamp edge, I'm all over it. I love swamp edges. So when I go into a cover, I'll know that cover, or I can either, you know, with an aerial, or I'm not still, you know, I'm going to be 62. So I'm, you know, I use a GPS enough to find a dog when I need to, but when it comes to everything else, you know, I'm still kind of old hat. And one of the things that we did years ago and with all my covers is we fly all of it. So each spring I get up, about every other spring, I get up and we fly that cover. And then during that, I'm able to see where new clear cuts have been and what's taken place and see different logging trails, just variety of everything. And then I mark that on my maps when I'm up in the air. And so I'm able to get a look at that, and it's a far better way to, for me to understand the cover and to know where I'm going to hunt. But it is without question edges.
And so, of course, one of the bigger mistakes we less knowledgeable grouse hunters make is probably walking through what I'll just call a monoculture, and it could be anything. It could be big conifers, it could be small conifers, it could be hardwoods. Is that what you see with people, you know, maybe who hire you finally after learning by trial and error that they don't know anything?
No, they're coming into a habitat that they know nothing about. A grouse hunt, you know, they've seen the pictures of a grouse hunt in one of the magazines with the beautiful colors, and so it becomes a bucket list hunt. And in many instances, it's portrayed as walking down a beautiful tote road, logging road, and And, you know, a grouse flushes and flies down the trail, and that's what a grouse hunt is. But when these guys are with me, I mean, it's, you know, we go where the birds live, and that becomes the whole deal. And so they have no idea what to expect or what to get into. But what I end up doing, I tell my hunters, if you can't see me, then you're out of line, because I'm going to be able to be right where the dog is. And the whole thing is, the dogs are hunting for me. They're kind of in a pattern. So we're not just following the dog through the cover willy-nilly. So I make the dog stay on an edge, or I make the dog, and I have that dog hunt in front of me. So I'm like driving a boat.
Yeah.
And I've got the tiller or the steering wheel, and you guys just stay with me, and I'll get you to where we want to go. There are times where the dog is going to pull you off where you want to be because they've got a bird that's out on an edge or on a limb. And then we can end up, but my coming right back into that same pattern and continue on, even though that the dog pulled us out on a bird that took us off our course. One other thing too, that I think that I know that needs to be discussed, is when you ask the question about one of the items, what are the items when you're on the prairie about approaching a dog or hunting behind a dog?
Yeah,
and the
yeah.
same would hold true in the grouse woods. Is oftentimes, and we had an incident last week where we had marked a covey down about 150 yards out from a gate, and it was a very foggy morning, so we saw him down, and the hunters got in such a hurry to get to where those birds went down. The birds had moved, and I knew they were going to move because it took us a bit to get the guns out of the, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, we get up, and the birds aren't there. They charge right on through without letting the dog hunt.
Yeah.
And letting the dog hunt the cover out. And the next one, I just stood back and I said, you guys, you've been hunting with me before. You know better than this. And I just shut up and didn't say anything. And of course, then the birds went out behind us.
I'm laughing with them, not at them.
They overshot the bird because they get in such a hurry and they don't let the dogs hunt. A very interesting point, even in the grouse woods, when I was doing so much work with Karina, when I would get to watch these guys handle dogs, some of the best grouse and cover dog handlers, when they would get to a birdie looking cover, they would slow down to a turtle's pace, because then that made the dog hunt the cover.
Yeah.
Because the dog is keen off the handler yet at that point. Even in the grouse woods at 100 yards, they're still keen off the handler.
Yep. Yep.
And if you're in poor cover, then they would not run through it, but they would pick up the pace and double time it to get through that bad cover to get to where the cover got good again. So those are some things that, you know, if, when you're in, you know, in varieties of different cover. And I guess if there's any one thing, and Michael McIntosh had mentioned it prior to his passing, that per step, there's no place he didn't think there's any place in the country other than Minnesota that had more grouse per step. And each step you take could produce a bird. And so, you know, those are all things to keep in mind.
You know, it's funny. I use the same thing when I'm fly fishing. When I get too careless and I speed up too much, I have to pretend that mm-hmm. right behind that next rock might be a 4-pound brown.
Yep.
It changes your attitude completely. All of a sudden you become a predator again. And I think that's part of it. But, you know, instead of a big rock with a brown trout behind it, here's my dilemma. I don't want to hurt any trees when I hunt grouse and woodcock, and I've done that way too many. I've murdered a lot of alders over the years. How do you help your clients cope with trees in the way of their shot?
I guess if there's anything, is that if it's not that our dogs are a better bird finder than the average dog, but what our dogs do is they have manners which are service oriented and user friendly, if you will, for the hunters. So once a dog goes on point, I don't allow my dogs to ever relocate on their own or self relocate.
Mm-hmm.
So once the dog stops and they're pointing their bird, my hunters can get out on the wings and in position where at least they have kind of an opening where they can move the gun if the bird should fly. But my response to that is, when they'll ask me, how do you shoot in this stuff, is if you get a glimpse of the bird, that's your shot.
Yeah.
The shot will get through the pattern, and the shot will get through the leaves and the trees, and And you know, they're not it's not like a late season pheasant to put a late season pheasant on the ground or to kill a grouse. And your average shot maybe in the grouse woods, maybe 30 yards, 35 yards would be a long shot in the grouse woods.
What? You're right, and you know, as most people know, that the game of skeet shooting was invented by grouse hunters to simulate the shots. All they need to do, really, that they never thought about, was putting about 40-foot telephone poles out there on the field with everything. But you're right, and we just have this mental block against hurting trees when they're going to live anyway, except for the ones I end up putting in my vest afterwards.
Well, yeah, it's just so you learn to block them out. And the other thing is, for people to, when they start learning to walk in the grouse cover, if you look out further ahead of you versus right in your face, if I was to look out 40, 50 yards when you can see that far in the grouse woods, you can make out a trail or a place that you want to walk. So you can at least kind of pick out a place which is a little bit more user-friendly.
Everything
versus just...
Yeah, everything being relative.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly.
Okay, do me and my good friend Randy Clark a lesson here. A lot of people might know Randy if they're in the industry. Randy's got a new dog that is just confused about that bell on his collar. In fact, when that dog, it's a she, when he puts a bell on that collar, she freezes up.
Yep.
And I have a wire hair. The last wire hair I had was the same way. How do you introduce a collar bell to a young dog?
I put the bell and a beeper collar both on the dog when they're in their kennel.
Yeah.
So if they're in their kennel running, that's home for them. I mean, it's like being able to put your stretch pants on and you feel good about being back home. So the dog can in and out of his kennel. It's a confident place for them to be. So they will learn to go in and out pretty quick. The bell and or a beeper both become old hat to the dog. So what you can do with both a bell and a beeper, so it's not so loud on a regular basis, you can put tape over the, the opening of a bell or your speaker on a beeper, so it's not quite so loud, or you just put a smaller low tone bell on the dog.
Yeah,
that's another thing. But I always start them out with a bell and beeper in their kennel.
Psychologists have belabored the point of a familiar object in an unfamiliar context, and vice versa. Yeah, so good stuff. And leading to the next question, which is traveling with dogs. You do this. You're just back from a long trip with several dogs. We don't do near as much as you do, but there's probably a few things you do that we do not do. Steve Grossman, or the Grouse Man, on the Upland Nation podcast, tell us what we should be doing differently about traveling with our dogs.
You know, I've got a topper box for my truck. You know, when I'm traveling now, I've got 9 dogs, so I can take 12 in the truck. So I'm traveling with 9 right now. Plenty of straw, you know, good bedding. Like anything else, fresh water when you can. They're still going to find some old nasty stuff to drink at some point. So I mean, you give them what you can. You know, other than that, they're, knock on wood, they kind of take care of themselves. Even, you know, when I'm out to out to the Wild Prairie Lodge and here in Minnesota, I've got an elevated kennel. So, you know, they're always dry. If it rains, everything falls through. And so they're never wet. So I don't have to deal with any of that. So, you know, that's a positive and it's a good thing. But I guess if there's any negative that comes from that is I do have to wash their nails a little bit more and clip their nails more often than a dog that may be on concrete. But, you know, it's other than checking the dog at the end of the day, you know, they're pretty easy keepers.
Well, you're a lucky son of a gun, I'll tell you. There are a lot of people who can't say that, and I'm one of them, although I'm doing my best to do the same things you do. All right. So finally, the most popular game bird in America is the ringneck pheasant, and you know a little bit about those. In fact, you'll be heading back to your prairie lodge in November to start chasing ringnecks. Any word on the situation out that way for the bird populations?
You know, they really took a hit in 2017 with the drought. And, you know, they've made the birds have come back a little bit here or there. The other big hit was losing all the CRP. And that was probably, of course, you know, that's been very detrimental, especially eastern part of the state. We're in a spot where we've got good pheasant numbers. It's not exceptional or over the top pheasant numbers. And I guess if there's anything positive that comes from that is we don't have big groups that come in to bird hunt with us. Our groups are pretty small. We keep it very traditional. It's a 2-on-1. If we have 4 guns or 6 guns that come in, then we have a guy for every 2 guns. So it's a very traditional style bird hunt. And if we are hunting more of a CRP kind of an area where we need a blocker, we'll put a blocker in on occasion. But for the most part, you know, it's still we're bird hunting. And an interesting thing, when I was training for Burnt Creek setters, and I still try to do this today when I'm by myself or with a smaller group, if I'm just with a 2-on-1 in a bird hunt, is I'll pick smaller pockets of whether it be cattails or smaller edgerows or section lines or something which has a breakup in it to keep the birds from running all the way through. And instead of putting a pointing dog into a section of CRP, I try to find smaller portions of cover, like you say at the end of a pivot field or a pivot where you can go in and it eliminates the feet of the crop edges, eliminates cover the pheasants can run to. And so I'm one of those that like hunting smaller cover in pheasant country, just so that it eliminates the places the birds can go.
And they will hold. I mean, I've seen this a bunch of times. They'll hold in that last bit of cover.
Absolutely.
Until when?
Well, you know, oftentimes it's until either A, you walk behind them, or yeah, the dog misses them, and then they'll try to blow up behind you. You know, they're gutsy. The whole thing is that we're playing in on their turf,
yeah,
and so they know what has got them to this point. What's the average lifespan of a pheasant is, what, 17 months, 18 months, and for them to live that long, they've had to be pretty cagey in some instances in order to live to be that old. So oftentimes it's coyotes or bobcat, avian predators, whatever. They've got to be pretty gutsy and wait to the last minute and blow out just when they think is right. And that's what's got them to that point. But I'm one of those, especially if it's a really nice cover, I'll slow down to barely a crawl and make the dog hunt the whole cover,
yeah,
and not to miss anything.
No, I'll never forget a time I was hunting in a field that had big tufts of grass, and I could see that bird running from tuft to tuft and stopping and hiding behind each one until he figured it was time to leave to go to the next one. What he didn't realize is his tail stuck out every time.
Sure.
But they are a lot more cagey, and we know it's not their brain, it's their instinct. But one thing that maybe you've seen more often than me is we fly a bird, we miss the bird. Well, I see that a lot. They land, we mark their spot where they hit the ground. Have you ever found one in that spot, or do you need to move somewhere?
Well, I will go to that spot and see if the dog can pick anything up from that point. Yeah, so in all these years, I've seen a couple different things. I've seen some, like all of a sudden, like there's Velcro on the bird's belly. And they will stay right where they landed, and there is no movement. And then other times, there's movement right from the instant they hit the ground. So the fun thing with all that is when you get to, as a guide, I get to watch different things happen. And you take in more of the hunt when you're not carrying a gun. And I become a much better dog handler by not carrying a gun. So I'm more of a student of what's happening and able to watch the birds more. And oftentimes it's, but the lion's share of the time, yes, the bird is going to hit the ground and they're hauling and running the minute they hit the ground, and they can go 360.
Yeah.
So you know, and there's an old term, I know you've heard it, it's called air washed, and whether that's true or not, once a bird has flown away, and it takes a bit to build up a any kind of a amount of scent, that's possible. Then the next comment is, well, if a bird it flies 50 yards and is shot at 50 yards and the dog went and pointed it dead, how can that be? So explain that difference to me. So it's going to be one of those for it's like the thermos question. How do it know to keep cold things cold? And how do it know to keep hot things hot? Is when you know about what scent is to a dog.
Yeah, we never will. I mean, they're better than us.
That's exactly it. You know, and years ago I was working, I did a deal with Delmer Smith, and one of the things we did is we put a small little smoke bomb down in the grass. So we have to assume this smoke bomb is our pheasant. And it gives you a visual of what the scent is doing, blowing that smoke bomb or that smoke from the smoke bomb off in a distance. So you can smell it at that point. So that resembles, it gives us an idea of how scent is moving or traveling. Sometimes it goes straight up, sometimes it's held way down, and it totally varies. So that's the thing with a pheasant that's flown off. And you know, I just look at it and say, well, he beat me today, tomorrow I'm going to get him.
Well, speaking of that sort of thing, and let's put a capper on that one, because here's my theory, and it could be a pheasant, it could be a valley quail, it could be anything in between. Could be a wild turkey for that matter. They're up in the air and they're better at this than any drone pilot I've ever met. They're scoping out their escape, their back door, if you will, while they're in the air. So no matter where they hit the ground, you think maybe they hit the ground and head for the good stuff, or do they just run?
You know, I can't answer that, because what I can answer you this, and when I was a student of all these pinred birds for 30 some years, what was interesting was when we'd get, I look at it this way, we would get new birds that go into the flight pens, and we'd go to herd them up to start catching them for releasing, and the first couple days they'd be okay, you could corral them and you could do pretty well. After that, it was like herding cats. They knew where the door was, and they would avoid that door like the plague. So all of a sudden, if a bird, I look at it as if a bird is not their first encounter, I think in many instances they have an understanding or idea where they want to go or what kind of cover they want to try to get to.
Yeah.
But their just first thing is to get out of danger, and then it's just hit the ground running, and then find a spot where they're comfortable with.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah, that's my case.
So the guy who does it for a living doesn't know either.
I don't have a clue. I just follow the dogs. The dogs teach me more than anything, and they don't tell me what it is I want to know.
I know, and as it should be, you know, follow the hunter with the longest nose. It's been my mantra for three television series.
Absolutely. You just love your dogs and follow your dogs. And the other thing is to trust your dogs.
Yes.
I've had more dogs make a fool out of me, and that doesn't take much, but they've made a fool out of me numerous times.
Yeah, you know, you can argue with a dog all you want, but when you drop the tailgate, they're in charge again, and you better admit that up front.
Yeah, get her done. And I never tell a good story about a dog that's still alive. It's always about the best dog that had already passed.
Oh, absolutely. I warn people of that all the time, and then I get caught doing it myself every once in a while.
We're all guilty of it, but they're a great companion, and in a nutshell, that's why I bird hunt.
And me too. And that's how I got started. And it sounds like you might have the same feelings about all of that. Steve Grossman, you can learn all about him by going to, let's see here if I can get it all right, Wild Prairie Lodge or thegrouselodge.com. Either one of those will get you to him, or you can probably just Google that name. It's unique enough that everybody's going to know how to find him. Man, I have learned so much, Steve. We got to do this on a regular basis, maybe in person. That's my promise.
So that would be great.
Look out. I
look forward
you.
To that.
This was a lot of fun. I know you're in between habitats and seasons, if you will. So good luck on the next one and then the next one after that. So thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate the opportunity, and be safe, and just all your listeners, just to be safe and remember, it's not about putting birds in your bag. It's just how you take them, and enjoy the time in the field.
Words to live by. Thanks again, Steve Grossman. Grossman, thanks again. Hey, still lots more to come here. The This Land Is Your Land segment will cover some I'll call it Central Montana public access. But first, let's just talk about your dog's safety. If you value your dogs as much as you, as I do, or Steve Grossman does, and I bet you do, you want to protect them in the vehicle as well as in the field. Gunner Kennels can help you do that. Gunner.com is where you learn more about their incredible dog crates. You know, a Gunner Kennel requires over 125 parts, and they're all manufactured and sourced from small businesses right here in the U.S. of A. That ought to be enough for many of you. But if you still need a little nudge, Gunner is the only 5-star crash-tested crate per the Center for Pet Safety. Certified. All other kennels? Meow. Not so much so. They failed the same standards. Watch the videos. You'll see why. They try their best to destroy a Gunner kennel, and it just doesn't work. Take the Fit Finder quiz, use the virtual reality app, and put your dog in the kennel. It's all available to you to browse at gunner.com, and of course, always free shipping. And I mentioned dogtruck.com earlier. Learn more about their incredible new IPX9K rating. Fundamentally, what that means is they are the most waterproof dog training collars in the universe. And that'll come in handy whether you're running a retriever or a wire hair in the rain and snow. Learn more about all their products, including this new waterproof rating, at dogtra.com. Use the coupon code SLUN10. Get 10% off any product over $200 and free shipping for the same amount. Thank you to Dogtra. They, among others, give us the time and resources to bring you this podcast. Thank you to Steve Grossman for all your help. And thank you to everybody who listens. Here's the good stuff. This Land Is Your Land is all about the stuff that we own or have access to because we pay for it in various ways. Walk-in hunting all over the country, including Billings, Montana. Many, many years ago, I did a speech for a Pheasants Forever chapter out there and was guided by one of the officers of the chapter to some incredible block management land out there that was available to us simply by signing in. Some of them you have to make arrangements in advance, but most of them you just go. There's a sign, there's a little kiosk, you sign up, and you go hunting. Billings, Montana is one of those places that doesn't sound like it might be a great bird hunting area, but it is. That's Region 5 in the Block Management Access Program, and you can get a map book of Region 5 and start your planning. There's at least a couple dozen spots within 20 miles of Billings, Montana. Northwest of town is the best place to start. Look for knee-high grass that bends in the wind for sharptails, a little bit shorter grass for huns, and you never know. Just like me and DJ, you might just actually jump a couple sage grouse as well. That This Land Is Your Land feature is brought to you in part by Huron, South Dakota, where the pheasants outnumber the people. Learn more at HuntHuronSD.com. And thank you for your support, HappyJackInc.com, dog care remedies of all sorts, internal external parasites, fleas and ticks, skin and coat pads and nails. They got it all at HappyJackInc.com. And if you heard that, it's because your hearing is still intact. Maybe it's because you're wearing electronic hearing protection from electronic shooters protection. ESPAmerica.com is where you learn more about all of their products, prices, choices, custom fitting. Well, I hope you learned as much from Steve Grossman as I did, and you can apply it this weekend or today or whenever else you're going. Maybe you're on the way to a hunt as you're listening. Be safe and have a good time. Hope you'll tell your friends, and I hope you will please leave a review at Apple Podcasts or any place else you listen to podcasts. It really does help. Thank you for those who have reviewed in recent days. BirdDog0903, Flyline, and BKL1954. Sure appreciate the kind words. I'll leave you with this from author Holbrook Jackson. He says, "Man is a dog's idea of what God should be." I can't argue that. I don't think I aspire to be in capital G God, but I sure love being regarded well by mine, and I hope you do too. All right, shoot straight. Take a newcomer hunting, if you will, please. Be safe. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in the field.